We have a request from the field commander, General McChrystal, for 40,000 additional American troops on top of the additional troops the administration sent in earlier this year. And the administration, I think, was a bit taken aback by that request. And so since August, they've been conducting a series of reviews to try and come up with an appropriate troop level.
And they've had about 9 reviews, I think the reports have said. And now the word is leaking out that it might be 30,000. Is there really a strategic difference between 30,000 and 40,000?
Well, that remains to be seen, really. The word I'm hearing is that the administration is close to a number around 30,000, and also trying to get our NATO allies to make up a good part of the difference. And so there's been efforts among the Europeans going to European capitals to try and get those additional troops.
And the strategy, Dr. Kaprenovich, that will be used to deploy these troops, we understand that it'll be a slow build-up. Is there any benefit to that?
There can be. It's not clear, for example, that we have the infrastructure in Afghanistan to accept that many new troops all at once. So it may require some time to build up that support level. Certainly, it'll help General McChrystal's strategy, which is really based on 2 elements. One is providing a much greater level of security to the population, and isolating the Taliban and the other insurgents from the population. And second, building up as quickly as we can Afghan army and police forces so they can begin to substitute for American and NATO forces.
And talking about that infrastructure for a moment, is there any possibility realistically that a lot of it could be moved from Iraq over to Afghanistan? And would that really make it easier than trying to ship things in from the United States?
That might be the case, but it's not clear how quickly we are going to be able to draw down in Iraq. The president's set a deadline of 2011 to have most U.S. combat troops out of Iraq. But what we're really talking about is a landlocked country that has very poor infrastructure in terms of roads and communication, airstrips, and so on. And so if you're going to deploy large numbers of additional American troops, you're going to have to take that into account. You can't move roads and airstrips from Iraq to Afghanistan. You may be able to move some other things, but again, it's not an easy task, and that could be a limiting factor in how quickly this buildup can occur, assuming the president approves it.
We're talking this morning to Dr. Andrew Kaprenovich. He's the president of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, and we're talking about the buildup that's anticipated in Afghanistan and that message coming from the president tomorrow. So talk to us a little bit about the strategy that will be employed here. Obviously, they want to help build up the forces within Afghanistan itself, and of course, we've learned all the difficulties about doing that over the years through our own involvement and through the involvement of other countries. Why would this be successful where other efforts have failed?
Well, in traditional counterinsurgency strategy, the population, not the enemy's forces, is viewed as the key or the center of gravity. The concept is that if we knew where the enemy was and who he was, we could defeat them rather quickly. We don't lack for firepower or anything of that sort. The key to getting that information is from the population. That's where the guerrillas and the insurgents circulate. The idea being that if you can separate the insurgents from the population will begin to give you that kind of information. So it's a protracted process, but it's worked in places, for example, like Iraq, and it's worked in historically in other insurgencies, for example, in the Philippines and Greece in the middle of the last century. So there is a track record here, but there's certainly no guarantee of success. Eventually, it's got to be the Afghan security forces and the Afghan people that win this war, and I think General McChrystal realizes that.
Yeah, in your testimony, you state that, yeah, we definitely have the speed and firepower, but the shortfall is the intelligence related to that center of gravity,
exactly,
which is the population. Do you think that McChrystal's plan solves that particular issue for the military?
Well, what he hopes to do is to secure the urban areas. Now, Afghanistan is primarily a rural country, but you've got to start somewhere. And so he's going to start where the population is densest, where it's greatest, and begin to work from that base and eventually expand the effort outward. Again, that's sort of a tried and true approach in successful counterinsurgencies. And so he's essentially trying to imitate what's been a successful track record in the past. But as I said, there are no guarantees here. But again, the additional 40,000 troops, I think, in his mind, enables him to get a jump start on that, enables him to provide trainers for the Afghan security forces, and once these security forces are ready, brings them in a circumstance where they're reinforcing success, not trying to avert a disaster.
And talk to us about the role of the Karzai government in all of this. He won a very contested election, one that really many people look on as corrupt, and yet it was, you know, there was not a revote. So will that be a factor in all of this? Can the United States really rely on him as an ally?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's a critical factor, and I think that's one of the reasons why the administration has undertaken this review. There's concerns that ultimately we can't succeed unless we have a competent Afghan government in place. And if it's riddled by corruptions and factions, then we're not likely to see that. And there's been a debate going on as to whether or not we need to set these conditions for Karzai before we add additional troops, or whether once we add the additional troops, we can then begin to set these conditions from a position of strength. What is concerning to some people is that to the extent that Karzai has doubts about U.S. resolve, the more inclined he is to work with warlords, to cut deals with them that basically trigger corruption within the government.
I mean, you have to have metrics that can be measured if you're going to measure progress. And some of the senators have been saying, yeah, as you mentioned, no money until we know that the Karzai government is going to stand up to what it needs to stand up to. But how do you measure a government's resistance to corruption or its backbone in standing up to forces like the Taliban?
Well, I think one critical element is not just American advisors with Afghan military units, but also American advisors within the Afghan government, and that goes for NATO advisors as well, in the ministries, not only keeping an eye on them, but helping them learn how to actually run a government and run it efficiently and without corruption. If you have those people in place and they're identifying people who are corrupt and Karzai still fails to remove them, I think that's one benchmark or that's one metric you can used to say, you know, Mr. Karzai, you're not following through on our agreement.
And Dr. Krupinevich, we've heard that there is an exit strategy that now has been put in the plan for the troop buildup. Is that a good or a bad idea to sort of telegraph your punch?
Well, I don't think the president can set a specific date there where we will leave. As it's said in the Pentagon, the enemy gets a vote in all this. And the enemy can make things more difficult for us, or if the enemy makes mistakes, can make things easier for us. I do think the president will try and sketch out what he considers to be a phased campaign where eventually we get to a successful endpoint. I don't think he'll set a specific date because there are just too many imponderables to consider here.
And it looks at, I just wanted to ask you about the effect on the U.S. military of all this. It looks like the Marines will be the leading force if we decide to build up there, followed by the Army. But in your testimony and other places have said that what the effect on the Army might be that we would have no reserve power left and that the Army could be in danger of being broken, as you put it. How real is that danger and what would we need to do to avoid it?
Well, that is a concern on two points. One is we already have a substantial number of troops in Iraq. Second, we have a very small strategic reserve among our ground forces, the Army and the Marines. So greatly increasing the number of troops in Afghanistan, number one, may risk having an inadequate strategic reserve if a crisis were to occur to, say, for in some other part of the world, in South Korea, for example, or with Iran. Secondly, there's the concern that at some point, soldiers and Marines that are rotated too frequently into combat zones, and these rotations really have been difficult. You're talking about people who are on their sixth and seventh tours in these combat zones, that eventually they either wear out or they leave the military or they just become relatively combat ineffective. They call it now post-traumatic stress disorder. We used to call it sort of combat stress and so on. Nobody really knows where you pass that red line and where these units start to break down in terms of their effectiveness. So that's another risk that has to be considered. And I'm sure the president is consulting with senior military leaders on this. And of course, they don't have an exact answer there. They're trying to gauge it as best they can.